Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 104, recorded October 26th, 2011. Kiss My EAS. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Omnia Audio and the new Omnia 11. Big market radio engineers are calling it effortlessly loud. Check it out on the web at omniaaudio.com. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are. I'm Kirk Harnack, host of the show, and glad you're here. This is the show where we talk about radio technology and all the stuff that goes between the laser pickup on the CD player or the head on the hard drive or the stylus on the end of the tone arm and takes it all the way to the transmitter and even out to the folks listening. Yeah, we're the guys who try to make all that radio stuff work. Radio's been around for, 80, 90 years or so, almost 100. We should do a history show on this one time. We're going to get an expert in on that. Speaking of experts, I got two of them with me. I'm not. I just try to host the show. We have the best-dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York City. It's Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I am well, Kirk. And yourself? Feeling well?
I'm lovely. I'm lovely. Good to see you again. Just saw you last Saturday.
Yes, that was a great panel. I had a good time. I hope you did.
I did. I enjoyed hearing what you had to say.
Oh, good.
Tell us why you're qualified to talk to us on TWiT.
Well, let's see. Last 26 years of doing radio in the New York metro area and other parts of the country. Worked at two major radio networks, and now I'm running a audio-video codec company. I guess that's about the best way to put it.
All right. We have lots of experience to send to them and lots of experience to help us out on this show as well. So you still have your hand a little bit in radio engineering. You're consulting here and there, aren't you? Somebody call you up. You talk to them. All right.
Oh, yeah. I'm working with two radio stations right now, building out transmitter sites and some studio linking, studio STLs. Yep.
Gotcha. Well, then also we have with us a guy who actually does radio work all day long. And on weekends, too, sometimes. It's Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris, glad you're back.
Well, thank you. I'm the president of nothing, except for maybe my own fan club. I'm the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee. There are five FMs, one AM. I also do contract work all over the place, mostly for AM stations. And I'm a frequent writer for Radio Guide magazine and also doing stuff here on TWiT.
Cool. Aren't you on the radio from time to time on Door County Station or something?
I am usually on Sundays from 10 to 3 at FM1069thelodge.com. I'm also, by the way, doing a presentation if you're an SBE member into streaming for radio broadcast. Check out the SBE site. I'll be doing a webinar in December on how to stream stations for radio.
That's very cool. Will you share that information with us here too, or have you already?
I think we've talked about it a couple of times, but this will be actually start to finish, choosing providers, setting up the infrastructure to stream. Should be a very good session.
Well, good deal. Well, hey, closer to the date, tell us, do you have to register for that? Do you go to the SBE website and register?
Yeah, it's actually already up. It should already be up on the SBE website. You can register for it there.
Gotcha. All right. SBE.org is the site, right?
Yeah. Oh, I like the lower third. Thanks, Burke. Yes, SBE.org is the website.
Jeez. All right. Well, I'm sorry. It's got me tickled there, that lower third. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, let's get on with the show. This is This Week in Radio Tech, where we talk about radio tech. And on the subjects today, there's a number of things to talk about. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about what happened this past Friday night. It was a celebration, a salute to the 50th anniversary of FM stereo. And so there was a panel on a nice program that was put together in lower Manhattan in the Tribeca area. And on this panel, this co-chaired by David Bialik and also Scott Feibusch, both of whom have been on this show before. But here are the participants in the panel. This is a who's who of FM radio, Dick Burton was on the panel, and he was an original member of the FM stereo committee. Now, Chris Tarr, I know you weren't there. Chris Tobin, you weren't at this event, were you? I didn't run into you there, did I?
No, I couldn't make the event. I had some family matters. But gotcha, I heard it was very good. It was a very good event.
It was very interesting to hear these guys' stories. Okay, Dick Burton was he was part of the committee, and he was part of the field test guys who were actually stationed in a hotel room checking out FM signals and making measurements and notes on how the different FM systems worked and proving out the one that we use today. Also on the committee, on the panel last Friday night, Frank Foti of Omnia Audio. And, you know, Frank wasn't around, you know, when the FM was developed. But Frank, who's one of my bosses at Omnia, Frank is promoting this idea. Not his idea. He's just promoting an idea that had been around for a while now and actually making it work of single sideband FM stereo subcarrier, which helps reduce multipath. Kind of an interesting idea. Also, Richard Mertz of Cavell and Mertz was there. Richard was in the Atlanta area doing a lot of early work, early 70s work in FM stereo. Arno Meyer was on the panel. Now, Arno, this guy's incredible. If you're in broadcasting, you've heard of Bell-R modulation monitors. Well, Arno Meyer started Bell-R, president of Bell-R, and back when FM stereo came along, well, you need a way to transmit it. You also need a way to measure it, measure what you're transmitting to see if it meets the specs, if it's legal, if your equipment is all adjusted right. And, nowadays, equipment is so modern that there's really not much in terms of adjustment. Setting a pilot level and a modulation level is about it. But back then, there were a lot of tweaks you had to make to get things just right on the air. And so Arno with Bell-R really was very inventive in coming up with proper ways to measure things. Hey, Robert Orban was on the panel. And, Robert Orban and Eric Small, who was also on the panel, together they came up with the original Orban Optimod 8000. And that was really an amazing feat of technology, putting the stereo generator and the processor together. So, in fact, Robert Orban and Frank Foti sat right next to each other, gave presentations close to each other. And Robert Orban is going to be a guest on this show coming up in a few weeks. He's also, I believe he might even also be on the Triangulation show, the one that precedes this one. So Robert Orban is in the San Francisco area, going to travel up to the Twit Network. That's the plan anyway. Skip Peasy, who's also been on the show, was on the panel. Bill Sachs, who's been on the case, some of these guys have been on the show, have been on the panel. And Eric Small, as I mentioned, from Modulation Sciences, was on the panel, too. So it was Herb Squire. Couldn't forget Herb Squire from WQXR was also on the panel. Now, what did they talk about? Well, I wish I could recreate it for you. And there may be a video that's going to be put up on the AES.org website. They did videotape and stream live this panel. But there were a lot of stories told about the beginnings of FM stereo. And the one thing that I want to relate, and Chris Tarr, help me out here, if you will, after I get started with a couple of these things. One of the points made was that the FM stereo standard has outlived, being 50 years old now, has outlived so many other technologies that have come and gone. A-track tapes, reel-to-reel tapes, cassette tapes, digital compact cassette, right, DCC, quad, right? AM stereo. The things that I'm mentioning have with the exception of open reel tape, all of these things have come and gone while FM stereo continues to be the standard. And what's interesting, DAT, there you go. Eric Duckman in the chat room says DAT tapes come and gone. Yeah. During the FM stereo area. DLT, I don't remember what that is. Is that like a BLT? String and two cups. No, Alex. And not only is FM stereo a standard in the U.S., it's a standard in all the countries around the world I can think of. Now, some countries use 50 microsecond preemphasis and some use 75 microsecond preemphasis. But other than that, the way we do FM stereo is standard everywhere in the world. Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, you guys got any more notions on things that have come and gone in that time? There was a whole page full of stuff on the on the screen. I just can't remember what they all were.
You top ones.
Yeah, as I say, you could have a whole show on what's come and gone between then. But I think it says something for how solid that standard was or continues to be and how well it works. it's easy now to conceptualize FM stereo now that it's been created and we've worked with it. But think about all of the design and thought that had to go into to creating this and all of the barriers that you had to overcome to get there. I mean, it's amazing that it even works at all. And the fascinating thing is it worked so well that it remains a standard today.
Yep, I would agree that it does actually work very well. It ain't perfect, but you know, in an analog world and with real world gear, it actually does work really well. You know, the early stereo generators were only capable of producing something like 27.5 dB of separation left to right channel, and so when the FM stereo rules were written, the FCC only required 27.5 dB of separation. I hope I got that number right. I think I do. And so it's interesting that the rules were written to match what the technology could do at the time. Now we can do a whole lot better than 27.5 dB of separation. We can now stereo generators built by my employer Omnia and by Orban are mathematically nearly perfect. They're just about as good as they could possibly be. I'm sorry, Chris Tobin, were you going to say something?
No. I was just going to say that I was going to agree with Chris that you can pick many topics that are come and gone, many technologies. But the FM stereo definitely has got to be probably the most robust when you think about it and what it has to go through. And even the technology FMX that was being developed to enhance the standard that we still use, that even came and went.
Oh, that's right.
So there's been a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. FMX, wasn't that Dolby's idea of how to make a lot of money selling chips to FM stereo manufacturers?
Well, actually, let's see. I don't know if Dolby was involved in the first. If I worked at a station that was one of the beta stations for FMX, and it was a company, it was a Broadcast Technology Partners out of Detroit. Mm. What the patents? CBS Labs in Stamford, Connecticut was developing the technology. And then they folded, the labs folded, and I think that technology was sold to a company, I want to say BT Partners in Detroit for some reason. I'm not sure why. But they're the ones that went on to continue developing it, and it was almost, I think they were doing DBX on the L-R of the stereo carrier. If memory serves me right, it was a companding system, and it was interesting the way it worked. I mean, it did improve the distance of the stereo signal, but I think the companding was a little too aggressive.
So to explain that to our listeners, the idea here was that when you're listening to an FM stereo station at some weaker signal levels, some distance from the transmitter side, you really do suffer a noise penalty when your radio goes to stereo. And I forget how much it is, but it seems like I've heard somewhere as much as a 23 decibel noise penalty on the signal to noise ratio being mono versus being stereo without a full quieting signal. And so this FMX system, the idea there was to compand the L minus R, the stereo difference signal, so that the noise wouldn't always be there. The noise would be masked by the presence of audio. Was that the idea?
That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you got to remember that the left minus right information is fairly weak compared to the left plus right information, so it degrades pretty quickly. Now, of course, what radios do nowadays is most radios, most automotive radios especially, will blend to mono as the signal gets weaker and weaker. Once you get lower and lower, or higher and higher signal noise ratio, or a lower signal level, you'll see the stereo pilot light will remain dutifully on and it'll say stereo, but really you're not anywhere close. It's almost completely mono by the time you get out to, I would say, 40, 50 dBU contours.
Yeah, yeah. Seems like a lot of those radios, too, will blend the high frequencies together before they blend the whole thing together. But, yeah, the idea there is car manufacturers to get the signals to be less noisy. It seems like FMX was also invented in a day when more listening was done with home stereos. And it seems like probably very little such listening is done nowadays with the ease and cheapness of other sources of music in the home. But in the car, people still seem to want, current items, traffic reports, weather, and to be entertained at the same time while they're moving around. Radio is certainly an easy way to get that. So, yeah, I can see where the mobile environment, you want to get that companding and or that blending in there together. Hey, guys, one of the things that caught my eye in the news in radio world online this week is an article by Mark Persons. And we've had him on the show a few times. We ought to have him back. But Mark's written a beautiful article that if you want to check out, it's on rwonline.com. It's about rebuilding that relic of an AM transmitter. Now, in the very studio where this show is being switched, produced, and sent out of the world, there is a rebuilt AM transmitter. It's a Collins. I want to say it's a Collins 820 D series. It's a 500 watt transmitter that was in the AM broadcast service and was modified and rebuilt by Mike Durow, famous audio processor maker and audio metering level maker, Mike Durow, to be an amateur radio amplifier. And so it's there at the new brick Twit House where this show is being put together at. Well, and so that's really cool. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of rebuilding that was done. Well, this article here about rebuilding an AM transmitter, Mark Persons talks about how to do this and how to get things cleaned up, how to make it easier on yourself, the sweat reduction factor, he calls it. He's got a good example here of a Bauer 707 transmitter. By the way, the Bauer 707, I'm not positive, but I think this transmitter was originally available as a kit or already built if you wanted it. You could build this 1,000-watt transmitter or 500-watt, whatever size you wanted, from a kit. Chris Tarr, in your work up there in the Mukwonago, Wisconsin area, you travel the highways and byways there. Are there transmitters there that you've rebuilt or that need to be rebuilt or worth rebuilding?
You know, a lot of that depends. A lot of it depends on budget. I almost never would recommend rebuilding an older transmitter for broadcast simply because, you know, nowadays transmitters are so much more energy efficient and the audio quality is better. You can modulate them harder, so, you know, you get better coverage. In most cases, and then they've also gotten a lot cheaper too. For example, one kilowatt Nautel transmitter, $14,000, which, as far as transmitters go, pretty inexpensive. But having said that now, a lot of times, those older transmitters make great backups. For example, I've got a 1957 RCA BTA-5T, which I've gone through several times with rebuilding projects. Works fantastically. A Bauer, I agree, you were talking about the Sparta Bauer, the 707. I've worked on those before. So there's another site that I have that I consult for that has an old Collins Power Rock. So a lot of those transmitters are great for backups, and I certainly would recommend doing that. They're great in those roles because they handle lightning well, and they're usually pretty sturdy when they're working. They just, nowadays though, for continuous duty, I really don't recommend them. But they all really do with the proper audio and the proper care and feeding. They sound pretty good, and they work well.
Hey, Mark Persons makes the point in this article. He says solid state transmitters need to see a 50-ohm load with little reactance in order to run properly. Old tube transmitters can run into a coat hanger, as many veteran engineers would say. So if the AM antenna is misbehaving, well, a tube transmitter can be your savior while antenna repairs are made. So, Chris Tobin, in your part of the world there where you have, look, I always think of the New York area as just having the most luxurious of everything and everything just always works right. You got budgets to cover any kind of problem. But I guess my misconceptions come to light here. You have to do emergency work there, and sometimes a tube transmitter could be helpful, could it not?
Absolutely. Several places I've worked at, we had backup transmitters that were tubes, and on many occasions when the antenna system's impedance varied from 50 ohms J0 to something very odd, the solid-state transmitters that were the primaries would fall back or shut off, and we went to the tube backups. And I also worked with some folks that like to say that the tube transmitters were a nice high pot tester for your antenna system if you're having problems. You could modulate those transmitters quite highly, and you could pop those components in the antenna system that were faulty, and there you go. So those are two uses for a tube transmitter. Yes, I've done it a couple of times. Not the high pot testing, just the run the tube transmitter into the antenna system that was somewhat not exactly 50 ohms J0.
Can you still get proper tubes for these things? Mark Persons makes an example of a transmitter using the 833A tubes. And the picture he's got in here shows the Amperex brand. I don't know where you get these things nowadays. Are they all Russian or Chinese made? Are those any good? You guys got any experience with that?
You can usually pick up the Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, over the years, I've used the Russian tube replacements that were on the market. They worked pretty well. And you can still find some of these things around. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, a lot of manufacturers where you buy FM tubes from, Richardson Electronics, places like that, also carry those tubes or either the Russian equivalents or whatever. So they're really not hard to come by. And in fact, a lot of times, too, you can find stations that had these old transmitters that had stocked up on new old stock. And, you know, sometimes those tubes aren't very good, but sometimes it's just enough to get you going. So I haven't really found that digging up tubes has been too difficult.
You know, you bring up a good point there. As we have the end of an era that's, well, I say that's, that we're reaching it. We may have already passed it, the end of the era of AM tube transmitters. Yeah, I know there's some out there still operating, especially some high power ones, but that haven't been replaced with solid state ones yet. But this idea of new old stock, I love finding new old stock. When I was doing engineering work on a real regular basis, it was exciting to go into a station that had a transmitter problem and then go searching around the cabinetry and see if I could find any parts for it. And lo and behold, you'd open a box up and there was not opened in 20 years was a fresh, you know, 833A tube or a 4-400 tube or 4-500 tube. That's a pretty cool feeling to pull that out and realize nobody's touched this thing in 20 years. And here I'm going to try to make it work in the transmitter. And you know what? Everyone I ever tried, the new old stock, that they all worked. I can't recall a single one that something had gone. I guess they could get gassy over time if they had a tiny, tiny, tiny leak. You know, in 20 years, the vacuum could go away, and then you wouldn't have a very good tube. That's a pretty neat feeling. Chris, either one of you guys, how many tube type transmitters are you still taking care of? I guess high power FMs typically could still have tubes in them.
Yeah, I've got several high power FMs, and then I have that one RCA that's mine, and then I have two AMs that I do some consulting work for, and they both have backup tubes transmitters. So I still get my hands in them quite a bit, and I enjoy it. I love those transmitters; they're a lot of fun to work on.
Yeah, I got a couple of folks that I'm working with that still have tubes, and you know, there's something to be said about that. It's fun when you're working them, tuning them up, and you know, peaking and dipping the meters and making things happen. It's a lot of fun, unlike some of the solid state, which just basically is power on. That's it.
I know a lot of people think I'm goofy, but here I am. I'm smiling ear to ear because this article by Mark Persons in RW Online. These pictures of these big tubes are, there's just something very satisfying about having this piece of gear, and it's got, you know, electronics in it, basic electronics. It's got big capacitors and big coils and big transformers and big diodes, maybe even mercury vapor rectifiers, you know, the kind that glow purple when they're trying to pass electricity one way and not the other way. And then you've got, you know, big tuning control. These transmitters just kind of feel manly, you know. and then you've got the tubes, right? And you know that the tubes are working because they emit just the right glow. If you ever walked up upon a transmitter with a couple of 833 tubes and the center is just, it's got a round cherry red, you think, ooh, man, that's a little bit too hot. Something's wrong here. Maybe the tuning's off. Maybe the load is bad. We're trying to modulate too much. It's always fun to, because you turn the lights out and things are still glowing so beautifully. There's something, I don't know, strangely engineeringly romantic about a glowing tube transmitter.
Well, and especially with AM, you know, when you got the nice big coils, they start to sing with the modulation.
Oh yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. There is, it's pretty romantic. And you're right. I mean, those transmitters were built like tanks. I mean, these things were built to last, and that's why a lot of them still run today. I think probably the primary reason for their, you know, a lot of these retiring are either you can't find anybody who knows how to fix them, or it does finally, you know, something breaks and it just is cost prohibitive to fix. But, you know, keep them alive while you can. And Chris is right. I save mine. I've had plenty of instances where I've had towerizing and things like that where, you know, my last resort was just putting the RCA transmitter back on, and you could load it into a wet noodle and it would work.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, that's like the grounded grid FM transmitters. You know, grounded grids would go into anything. Dead short, practically.
Yeah.
You know what? AM Transmitter I used to work on many, many years ago that had, I think it was the A33 tubes. And in the plate section that was actually had these fins that when the tube heated up internally, they'd rise a little bit. It was I believe it was the A33As. It was a certain brand, certain type, and it was always fun to watch that from the backup standby transmitter. You turn it on, fire it up, and as Chris pointed out, you hear the coil start to sing with the audio, and then the tube starts to glow, just a little cherry, you know, a little amber color, and then the fins would just open up, and you can see inside and see the cathode and the grid and everything else of the tube. Of course, if you went too far, then it got a little ugly. But yeah, there's something magical about it. You're right, Kirk. When you work on these things. You know, RF is still magical no matter how you look at it. And the AM transmitters, I think, were the best. And there's always that smell, you know, Bakelite and the other things that come out of a transmitter.
Sometimes if the smell is a mouse giving up its last bit of moisture on the top of a plate transformer, well, that smell wasn't always so good. Oh, I know I've spent a lot of time cleaning mouse trailings out of transmitters. Why do mice like transmitters so much? Is it just the warmth? Is it the risky lifestyle?
Both. I don't know mice to be huge risk takers, but I do know that those transmitters are often nice and warm, and there's plenty of big openings for them to get in and out of. So,
yeah, and not so much with today's modern rack mounted solid state transmitters. Somebody said, "Hey, old tubes sing, transistors just fail."
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I could agree with that. Hey, we're going to take a break here and tell you about our sponsor. When we come back, we've got a little bit more news on the upcoming EAS, the national EAS test. So hang on for that. And we'll also, if we need to take a couple of questions from the chat room, that's fine, too. Next week on This Week in Radio Tech, our guest is Bob Holowenko to talk about some of the ways to get interesting services from your phone company that will really help yourself from an IP audio point of view, getting good services like voice over IP, getting these things to be reliable like they can be and like they should be if you just do it right. So be sure you tune in next week for This Week in Radio Tech, and Bob Holowenko is our guest. Our program is brought to you by my employer and my friends at Omnia Audio. There's a new product from Omnia Audio that's pretty interesting. It's the Omnia FXE. This is file-based audio processing, the Omnia FXE. I'm going to tell you about a couple of products and their status right now, but FXE is pretty interesting. If you produce podcasts, if you produce any kind of audio that once you produce it all, maybe you're ingesting audio that's at varying levels and you'd want to get it all to be, at the right levels. Well, Omnia FXE is a file-based audio processor. You can do it from a command line. You can have the program watch a folder. When a new file comes in that folder, it can grab that file, process it, and put it back out. And you get to set the processing. There's presets in Omnia FXE, and you can also adjust those presets. Omnia FXE is being used by a couple of the world's largest online music services. And they're using it to very good effect. They have to ingest a lot of new material, whether it's interviews or whether it's live performances or just the songs as issued by the record companies. They want to get all these songs processed similarly so they play back at consistent levels over their web stream. So Omnia FXE is a good way to do that. You can also drag and drop files into its user interface if you just want to do occasionally that sort of thing. The other thing I want to mention to you is, Omnia 11. A lot of you have Omni 11 processors now, and a lot of you have them on order. I know because we have a backlog right now. There are some new presets available for Omni 11 for news and talk and sports. Cornelius Gould, Corny, Frank Foti, Mark Manolio, and Rob Dye have all gotten together and come up with these presets specifically intended for FM news, talk, and sports stations. So if you are one of those, you're going to want to check those presets out at the omniaaudio.com website. And finally, if you go to omniaudio.com, you might notice something on the front page. There's a countdown clock. And right now, it's counting down 16 days, 3 hours, 28 minutes, and 43 seconds. If you're listening to this podcast later on or watching it later on, the clock probably has a little bit less time than that. It's counting down to the end although it hasn't started yet, the end of a very interesting promotion. And can't tell anything more about it. You can click on that all you want to, and it'll just take you to a page that doesn't tell you much. Can't wait, can you? So I want you to keep your eye on that. And come November 1st, there'll be an interesting announcement there. So check it out. Our show again brought to you by Omnia Audio at omniaaudio.com. Oh, yeah, and one more thing. Leif Claesson is in country. He's in the U.S., and he's taking the new Omnia 9 to a few beta stations and making sure everything is ship-shape before we ship the first ones. So big shout-out to Leif Claesson. Glad you're here. And he'll be in the U.S. for another couple of weeks until he heads back home to Thailand. All right, let's continue on with This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks again to Omnia Audio for being our sponsor on the show. All right, guys. We're going to get to EAS, but first, another Radio World Online article says this is definitely a major win for the entire radio industry. The decision by an examiner at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in the radio automation patent dispute has industry observers optimistic about the ultimate outcome for broadcasters. I think a lot of us thought it would go this way anyway. At least we hoped it would. As Radio World reported, the examiner has rejected many of the key claims in the patents. Mission Abstract Data had sued several of the largest broadcast groups for patent infringement involving hard disk automation technology. But an ex parte patent reexamination request by Broadcast Electronics, that's a radio automation supplier, they weren't named in the original patent infringement lawsuit, has led to the latest development. So there's more information on this on the Radio World website at rwonline.com. And, this is great. This was such a distraction for so many people. This patent claims that if you're that it's a patent on moving songs around on a network so they could be played back on the air. And, we have a lot of opinions about how crazy some patents are. By the way, the article does go on here. They searched out everyone, collected the data, and crafted the challenge to the patents. It's a good thing that they were so thorough, as it turned out that Arrakis Digilink was the only indisputable prior art. How about that? Arrakis Digilink, the only indisputable prior art. The industry owes BE, who did a lot of this research, a debt of gratitude for their personal and corporate sacrifice on all of our behalf. That's according to Mike Palmer of Arrakis. Chris, did I hear you about to say something? Sorry.
I'm not sure which one, but I can say the Arrakis Digilink is true because when I was at ABC, we were doing many various things. I guess you'd call them time shifting now, but mm-hmm. That conversation came up a couple of times about prior work and patents, and they were one of the folks I remember hearing about. So yeah, it's been around a while.
Turns out there's a Arrakis Digilink audio manual, a manual for one of their workstations dated 1992, where this same kind of activity was going on. So I'll be glad to quit talking about this issue. It's such a distraction, and a pox on patent trolls. If you think you've really got a case, fine, but this is one where most people in the broadcast industry thought, no, this is not something that should be pursued. There was prior art prior to this patent. And does that mean the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office makes mistakes? Yeah, I think it does. Should we stop patenting things like that? Well, that's up for debate. Mr. Tarr, you got a thought about that?
Well, there was a great, if you go to my website, broadcastengineering.info, there's a great conversation about that, including a link to a PBS investigation on it. And what it boils down to is this company existed solely to find a patent that they thought they could make money off of. So,
no,
I know
shocked.
It's a surprise. I'm surprised. But it's funny because you look at their site and they talk about how they're on this mission to, hard drive automation had changed the industry, and they don't know what they're talking about. They just basically had a bunch of lawyers find these things. And there's one company that bought up all these libraries of patents. It's all they do. And then they look through them and see what's out there that might be able to work. And then they sell them off to these companies who then try to implement them. So, it really was. It was obvious that it was somebody who had no clue how the industry worked or any idea about the history of the industry, because it never really should have even gotten this far. So I'm just glad it's going away. It should have.
All right. Hey, Chris,
I'm shocked. There's gambling going on here.
I'm shocked. Yeah. This company was only
carry your winnings, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Chris, Tar, I think you may have mentioned earlier that you had some information about there's some new information about this national test and a pamphlet, a manual, something that we have to now get.
A few things. Actually, the FCC announced two initiatives yesterday, and you can go to the FCC's website. I'm going to look down for a second here to look at it. I have it written down. FCC.gov/nationwide EAS test, all one word. And what you want to do there, if you're the responsible party, is they have a new handbook that is to be used only on the day of the national EAS test. It looks just like the other EAS handbook, but it supersedes it for that one day. And if you know about the posting rules, you must have that booklet posted into your control point. But it's only active for that day. So grab that, download that. They also have the information on the website and how to register your station. Because as you know, the FCC is going to require you to register your station. And then after the test runs, you have to go back in and file either file paperwork, real paper and mail it in. I don't know who do that. Or do it online and fill out a quick survey and put in some information about how the test worked. But those are some things we've been waiting on to get kind of clarified by the FCC, and they've done so now. So be sure to download that and print out that booklet from the FCC website and post that in your control point, and also familiarize yourself with the website. And there's already a place there to enter in preliminary information, including the location of your station and some contact information and things like that. So also, if you haven't also done that, if you have a Sage Digital NDEC, actually all the different EAS encoders have bulletins on their websites about what to do to prepare for the test. But there's one in particular with the Sage NDEC that's very important to read about audio levels. So if you haven't yet, you really got to start thinking about this, because although most devices will pass the EAS, the National Emergency EAN, automatically, there are some caveats, and you just want to make sure that you're ready to go, because you probably don't want to be the one that doesn't pass the test. Although I have heard through the grapevine that the FCC will not be handing out fines, but I wouldn't want to test that out.
But you may have to stay after school.
Yeah. But it'll be interesting to see. One of the things they're talking about, the Sage, the digital NDEC, is that there was an issue with levels in this version of the firmware, where apparently the input levels can be so loud that it superimposes itself onto the playback that's happening in real time. So you've got the audio that's coming down, then, you know, the 6 seconds or whatever of ahead of audio that's being fed into the box at the same time, and it goes into this loop, this feedback loop, which causes the audio to degrade. And so, you know, you very much want to check the website to take care of that. It's pretty easy to fix. It's just adjusting your input levels.
This thing is about 23 pages long. 23rd page, 22nd, 2th page is just for notes. So, yeah, it's worth downloading. If you go to that webpage that Burke was showing on the screen, what was it, FCC.gov/, what was it, Christar?
I have to look down at my notes again. It is nationwide EAS test, all one word.
Gotcha. And as soon as you go to that URL, it switches you to a different one, but the one that you mentioned is the easy one to remember.
Right. Another thing that some people surprisingly, I guess I would say surprising, because it's kind of confusing, that some engineers haven't quite grasped yet, is that every other test that you run on an encoder is storing forward. So the alert comes in, it gets recorded into the memory of the box. When the alert is over, it's then rebroadcast from your box. This is the only type of alert that will actually be real time, that will not be stored forward. As soon as the test comes in, it starts and the audio channel opens, and that audio channel is live, and it's live all through the chain from where the audio starts to all of the entry points to you. So that's one of the interesting things about these tests, and one of the reasons they want to go more than 2 minutes, because most boxes have a 2-minute record limit, and they want to make sure that in this situation, when you're not recording, that it doesn't just automatically time out after 2 minutes. So that's another thing to kind of think about, that you can't, and this isn't one of those things you can record and play back later. You actually, it will be done in real time.
You know, I think that's important, because most of the time the text of a test or even an actual emergency, you can spit that out. You can say that in under 2 minutes. But I don't care who the president is. He might talk for more than 2 minutes.
Right. Yeah. And that was the point is, you know, we want to make sure that these boxes do what they say. And there's also, if you haven't seen it yet, by the way, before I forget, there is a great, and I'll have to see if I can find the link and post it up. Barry Thomas posted a great YouTube video that actually simulated that. He had a Sage specially configured to, which you can't normally do under normal circumstances, but had one modified to actually transmit the EAN and had a receiver and actually went through a 3.5-minute test with the box to show you what would happen and the series of events that would happen when this test comes. And it was really real enlightening. You could see exactly how the boxes acted and how they were, how they worked and interacted together for this live test. And he recorded all that, put it up on YouTube.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Actually, we had that on the show last week, so I'm glad you brought it up. Remind people to go to YouTube and have a look at it. I said we'd put the link up. You know what? I think I probably failed to do that. But I'm sure if you search EAS test on YouTube, you'll find that video. We actually watched it here on the show, a couple minutes worth of it. But thanks for bringing that to our attention again.
Okay.
Chris Tobin in the New York area, you think this is going to go pretty well?
I think so. Folks here in New York have been practicing, checking everything, reviewing procedures. Like I said, I think last week, the week before, when we talked about the EAS, here in New York City, the broadcasters have been very proactive at working with both local government and amongst ourselves. And we've got the system really, humming along, if you will. So I think this test should actually go without a hitch. You know, boxes will turn on. I'm just curious about stations that are automated, that don't have anybody on site and are participating in EAS, and curious how that's going to roll out. What we're going to hear from the reports after the tests are done.
But yeah, here's the other thing: is that non-participating stations still have to do this? So that'll be interesting to see as well. In the past, the rules state that in a state of emergency, non-participating stations should shut down, but that the exemption to that is EAN. So there is also a notice that stations that normally wouldn't do that must do it. They must carry the EAN because that's even if you're not participating, you are required to do that. So it'll be interesting to see how many of those work because you never really test those. So it'll be interesting to see how those perform.
The looks like this manual speaks to that on page 16, but maybe we're reading different things here, Chris Tarr. This says for manual operation that you can transmit the following. It includes this is a nationwide test. During this test, most television providers. This is, insert station name. We will be discontinuing programming for the duration of the test. Our programming will resume at the end of the test in about 3 minutes. So what does that mean?
And are you sure that's the manual for that day and not the the standard manual? I'm pretty certain check on that.
I guess we read different things. Yeah, this is the handbook for November 9th, 2011. And this says for non-participating stations. It's on page 16. So, well, there's a point of lack of clarity. Huh.
Yeah, I'll have to look at that. For some reason, I saw that in an email today where in fact, I'm going to look at it now. I can find where I have my notes.
I think we should just run War of the Worlds for 3 minutes.
Yeah, well, there you go.
There you go.
The solution.
there's this news story on Radio World Online, rwonline.com. I know I keep referencing them because they are, a good, great source of information. Here you go. If you go to this article at rwonline.com, it's called Online EAS Test Report Form now available. There is a link at the bottom to the reporting forms and to the manual that Chris has been mentioning that you can download. It's just a PDF, so easy to print out and put at the points of EAS remote control. So there you go. Cool. All right. Chris Tarr, did you have anything else this week that was on your mind? We didn't get to talk much before the show about setting up what all of our topics were on the show. Do you have something else in mind?
Well, that's all I've been working on is the AS stuff. That has pretty much been been my life the past few days, because you can't underestimate how important this is, and like it or not like it, it's here and it's not too many days away. So, especially in a situation like where I have, where I'm doing consulting work for other stations, I'm kind of their engineer. So I also have to worry about them and making sure that they're set up as well.
Gotcha.
And
in this test, you still
have to make sure HD 2 and 3 interrupts as well, correct?
Oh, do you?
Huh. Yes, you do. You absolutely do. So, yeah. You should have been doing that already. Like I have mine slaved to the master channel, which is really how you're supposed to do it. So I actually have an interrupt box that whenever the audio, whenever the alert gets fired on my EAS box, it automatically interrupts the audio on HD2 and plays the alert through.
I only say that because we've been talking. The articles I've read, people I've talked with, HD 2 and 3 never came up in the conversation. And I know at my last job, we were very, very particular about those things and always reminding internally what to do with that whenever we did any of the tests. And I just realized, listening to our conversations, we never mentioned it. So, HD 2 and 3 is definitely part of the equation for November 9th.
This is another subject that I will be glad when it's over. I realize we all have to be prepared, and we hope the test goes off properly, and we get the White House's message on the air, and that way we can show. It'd be a good learning experience to see where the system fails.
That's kind of where I'm at with it. It is a big pain, and it's frustrating, and it's all these things, but I really am. The curiosity has gotten the best of me on, will this actually work? Because this is exactly what it was designed for. And we actually have never tested it to see if it would actually do it. So I am curious to see how it all turned out.
Why do you think we've never done this level of test before? A nationwide EAN, Emergency Activate. Well, yeah. What's EAN stand for?
Emergency something. I don't know.
This is the problem, isn't it?
But I think we haven't done it for this reason, because it takes a lot of coordination, and you are talking about interrupting the programming of every radio station in the country, and typically the FCC has kind of been not wanting to get into that, about running controlling what goes on the air. So I think it's been very sensitive, and there was a lot of pushback even for just this. But I do think that if this goes smoothly, I do think that it's not out of the realm of possibility that we'll see this happen again in a couple of years.
Yeah. Do we all long for the days of Conelrad?
You see, there's something else that was never tested. We never had an actual test of Conelrad.
Now stations did test the frequency switching part, didn't they? Or did they? I would have thought so.
Since I wasn't doing it back then, I don't have any notes of it ever happening. On any of my engineering notes for the stations that I've had, I've never seen any notes about transmitters actually having done it. I know that I work with transmitters that can, but I haven't seen any notes that they've actually ever did.
Yeah, I have to agree. I worked at several stations with Conelrad transmitters with the switches on them, but none of the log books dating back way back indicated any tests were ever done.
So it turns out EAN, thank you, Wikipedia, does stand for Emergency Action Notification. Three words that normally would not roll off my tongue. Emergency Action Notification. And that's what EAN stands for. And that is one of the same codes that has never been tested. It says it can only be activated by the president or their representative, like the vice president. So it's the EAS system that carries the emergency action notification.
Here's something else interesting that they keep talking about. It's a possibility that the end of message headers won't get sent, and instructions on how to take care of that.
Why is it a possibility that they won't get sent?
I think it has to do with the fact that, in theory, they should be fine. They're saying that they really shouldn't be an issue, but there's a possibility because of the relaying that somewhere along the line, one of the boxes in the daisy chain will turn off and stop sending the alert before the EOM is sent. In most cases, most devices should automatically, from what I'm understanding, should automatically put an EOM on there. But they are saying, giving you instructions on what to do if that doesn't happen. So again, if you're not, if you like, for example, with me, where I have stations where you know, they don't have an engineer. I have to instruct whoever's there on what to do if that's if that situation arises. And then, of course, with my stations, I'll be there to make sure that that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in this case, it's called an emergency action termination. It has its own same code, EAT, as opposed, well, you use the term EOM, which is a good old radio engineering term for any kind of end of message, EOM, whether it's a 25 hertz tone on a reel-to-reel tape or a tone on a cart machine or a simulated or, you know, virtual tone on a automation playback computer system. But I've heard that, too, that and stations are to absolutely wait, I guess, until maybe wrong programming comes down the line before right. they take any action to get their Sage or other brand of boxes out of the line and return the normal programming themselves. So that I don't know. I that makes me uncomfortable that somebody is so unsure that this is a possible or so sure that this possibility that. That the test may not terminate properly and stations automatically return to normal programming.
Well, I don't know that it's that they're thinking that it's a huge possibility. I think it is a possibility. And again, we've never tested it, so we just don't know. So it's kind of covering all those bases. It's like, well, you should get the end tones, but if you don't, here's what you need to do if that happens. So there's just so many things that are up in the air with this because it's never been done at this scale. It's kind of like, well, all the engineers think it should work just fine, but here's a list of things that could go wrong.
in the chat room, N6LV says he was in the Ground Observer Corps back in the mid-50s. Connell Rad was taken very seriously back then, and so I'm pretty sure the stations I engineered for prior to my being there, because it was all EBS when I came along in engineering, but they had done the switching, the Connell Rad switching. And that was back in the day when enemy bombers could use AM broadcast signals to home in on towns. That the whole town may turn the lights out and go dark so that enemy bombers couldn't see them, right? But if the AM radio stations were still on the air, then the enemy bombers could home in on them and find them. So I guess part of the idea of Connell Rad was that you'd either go off the air and quit transmitting, thereby quit providing a homing beacon to the bombers, or you would switch to one of two frequencies that were the only two frequencies on the air across the country. And with all these stations on the air on these two frequencies, one was at the lower end of the AM band, one was up at the upper end of the AM band, then it would confuse the bombers. They couldn't home in on any one particular one because there was just so much RF out there. Carrying this. Is that a decent explanation, or am I just all washed up? Yeah, there's a website.
No, that's probably the best way. That's the best explanation.
That's exactly what it was. Because, a lot of times you could say, well, for example, in Chicago, 890 WLS. So if you want to bomb Chicago in the dark, home in on 890. The two frequencies, by the way, I believe were 640 and 1240. For the two
Yes.
I think you're right.
Connell Rad stood for Control of Electromagnetic Radiation.
Ah, okay. Sure enough. Yeah. Well, again, Wikipedia is your friend. It even had its own logo. There's a website, connellrad.com, that is fairly interesting, too, with a lot of old reprints of old stuff that they had back in the Cold War days. Yep. All right. Well, guys, we've beat this subject to death. I hope we've learned something about it. We certainly learned where to go on the interwebs to get information. If you're a broadcaster, if you're a broadcast engineer or a program director, you it's your responsibility to make sure that this test happens correctly at your radio station. There are a couple of different web resources. One of them was fcc.gov/what, Christar?
National EAS Test.
fcc.gov/national EAS test. That is if you got to go somewhere, that's the place I would certainly go for plenty of information. And download and print. Download and print the handbook that's required just for November the 9th. After November the 9th, you can burn it if you want to. But and then there's a reporting structure. You're supposed to report how the test went for you. You won't be penalized if it didn't go well. You won't even have to go stand in the corner. At least the FCC won't make you do that. All right? And there's this video that's on YouTube that we looked at a bit of last week. Show notes? Yeah, maybe we'll do that this week. All right. Guys, we're out of time. And I want to promo the fact that next week on This Week in Radio Tech, we're going to have Bob Holowenko as our guest. And then he's going to be talking to us about some telephone company services that you may not know about to get yourself some better services for your radio station. Make your IP telephony more more reliable. Make it, if you use IP audio to transmitter sites or to do remote broadcasts, can make that more reliable too. So Bob will tell us about that. Also coming up, another Bob, and that is Bob Orban will be our guest sometime in the coming weeks. So we look forward to hearing from him. And also, we have agreement now with a really famous gentleman in the radio industry, and that is Jeff Mendenhall. Jeff has agreed to come on our show. Jeff spent the day today, in fact, with Tom Ray. That's why Tom's not on the show at this time. Tom was installing some new modifications to his Harris transmitters in New York City to install that system where they can control the carrier level and save you some money and see if it's compatible also with HD radio, which Tom Ray does at WOR. So Jeff Mendenhall was there, and he's agreed to be on our show as well. All right, it's time to pick a winner for our giveaway here. We're giving away an Omnia AXE license. This is software that you run on a PC, runs under Windows as a service, so it's pretty reliable. It just sits there and runs on some utility PC. It will take in audio from any Windows recognized source. It will process that with Omnia audio processing and then encode it into an MP3 or AAC stream of your choosing.
Sweet.
And then you've got a stream to listen to. You can stream to a Shoutcast server from there. You can stream that to one of the common service providers, Stream Guys or Live365 or those kind of things. So what I need, let's see, how about Mr. Tobin? If you would close your eyes, shake your head, and think of a number from 1 to 12, we'll there you go. All right, give me the number, Mr. Tobin. That's enough shaking.
Nine.
Hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, we have a winner. And the winner is at Stryker Audio. At Stryker Audio. I will be contacting you later on this evening. And you have won. You scored yourself an Omnia AXE license. So thanks a lot, Stryker Audio. And thanks to everyone who retweeted the beginning of the show. Appreciate it very much. Hey, we got to go. Burke in Petaluma, California. Thank you so much for producing our show and putting up with our zaniness and so forth. You there, Burke? Thank you. Thank you, Burke. Appreciate you. Thanks to our I assume he's there. We're on the air. Also, thanks to our sponsor this week in Radio Tech, Omnia Audio. This week, check out the website at omniaaudio.com and check out that countdown. It's going to get interesting come November 1. Also, thanks to Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin. Appreciate you, Chris.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. We enjoy being had. And also, thanks to Chris Tobin from New York City. Appreciate seeing you today, Chris.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Good night, everyone. Good day.
All right. We'll see y'all next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
Yay! I know what it feels like to be Madonna.